Hey there, and welcome to The Jeffrey Van Dyke Show, a podcast for paradigm changers. Each week, I speak with another influential leader who's changing the conversation for their audience, their industry, and this world. I am so glad you're here. Welcome to the show. Okay, welcome, Tanya Sermon. So excited to have you here. So for those tuning in, I want to tell you about this amazing human being. So Tanya Sermon is one of Canada's leading social entrepreneurs. I love this in her bio, her clients, people and planet. Her superpowers, visionary ideas that inspire, models that harness collaboration, and spaces that accelerate systemic change. We'll hear all about that as we get into it. Just a few highlights from her career over the last 20 plus years. So she co-founded and leads the Center for Social Innovation, a pioneer in the co-working and social enterprise movements that catalyzed more than 100 world-changing initiatives, developed the Constellation Model, a multi-stakeholder partnership framework that was used to ban toxic chemicals and baby bottles, thank you very much, and organize 40,000 plus Ontario nonprofits, 40,000 plus Ontario nonprofits into a network with policymaking clout. So this woman knows a thing or two about getting the we and the mighty together. A bunch of other stuff, Community Bond, a groundbreaking social finance tool that raised $6.3 million to purchase $25 million in real estate, housing 70 plus social entrepreneurs, and launching Catapult, a microloan fund that galvanizes government, corporate, and nonprofit partners. So, Tanya, it is just, I'm so looking forward to this. You're like a sister from another mister from the moment we met, and we got lots of ground to cover. Here's where I want to start. We'll get into the some of the different work you've done and what you've learned. I want to start here because so oftentimes our childhood are things we kind of try to just get through and get over and move on from without seeing the gift in it, without seeing how our life's journey and some of our life struggles prepared us to our life's giftedness. You know, in my preparation for this conversation, one of the things you talk about is having a scrappy childhood. So tell us just a little bit about how you grew up.
So thank you. Thank you for the question. And Jeffrey, I'm so excited to be here with you. You know, so I'll just jump right in. You know, my upbringing was a very, I guess, unconventional start. So I was born to teenage parents. So that's important to start. My mother was 17 when I was born. And, you know, y'all are based in California, but my family's from Northern Ontario. The land, we call it the land of white trash. So my lovely 17 and 20 year old mom and dad were very, very young. And my father was a musician in the 70s. And my mother was the, you know, pushed into motherhood very, very early. My mom left us when I was four. I had a little sister who was one, not even a year old when my mom left. And my dad raised my sister and I. And I think the word raised is kind of loose. We weren't. I like to, sometimes I describe us as the wild children, you know, the dirty girls. It was kind of like, discipline was not a framework. And you know, dinner was whenever you scrounged it out of the kitchen. So, you know, it's interesting because I started with this very, very, very scrappy kind of like, you know, raising my little sister, my dad being this crazy hippie. And then his form of childcare was really interesting, right? Like here he was, this musician on the road, he'd put us to sleep and then he'd leave us and he'd go and hit the clubs to play in nightclubs to make enough money to sustain us. And eventually he was like, okay, how do I get these kids some babysitting? But he didn't have any money. He was broke, broke. So we ended up getting to be, we were quite good at ballet and at gymnastics and like all these little things. And the Toronto District School Board in Canada, you know, a hearken to our incredible education system here in Canada. I think it was probably the thing that saved my life. to be honest, because my sister and I were able to get into programs that were really specialized. So I ended up being trained as an elite gymnast, trained for the Olympic team in a special school, and then eventually went into an arts program and studied theater and dance. And, you know, my dad was a great dad, a loving father, a crazy hippie, a new age sensitive guy. He used to, one day I remember him receiving a 1 metric ton of crystals into the living room to, you know, and dowsing to see, you know, whether I was going to make it home and whether I'd lied if I didn't make it home in time at night. So it was interesting because we really grew up very poor, and by Ontario standards, that's still pretty wealthy and pretty privileged. But it definitely made it so that my sister and I were on our own a lot.
Yeah.
And we were confronted with the challenges of figuring out, you know, how to navigate the world in a different way without a strong parenting infrastructure, but with a real strong sense of values and, you know, a lot of love. So, you know, maybe not a lot of food, but yeah. A lot of love.
Yeah. Yeah. You've done a lot of stuff in your career so far. Mm. And you do a lot around stakeholders and community building and coalitions. You've also, I imagine, had to be pretty darn scrappy to figure out how to do some of the things you've done. Like, over the years, my guess is you've seen how you grew up has contributed to what you've been able to do. And I'm wondering if you could just reflect a bit on that.
You know, we grew up with a very strong spiritual practice from a very young age. So like I said, I was raised by a hippie. And when I say hippie, I mean like Eastern philosophy, new age, meditating. Teach your daughters at 5 years old how to meditate. And you know what? It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I thought he was crazy at the time, but honestly, it was a phenomenal beginning. And I think what happened was, as I sort of grew up and started to navigate the world, I really learned that I was powerful.
Mm.
I learned, because my father wasn't constantly there. In fact, he was almost never there. You know, we were the wild children. We were raised feral. And so we had to navigate and look and see around the world. And what the world showed me was that I was powerful, that I actually had agency, that I could reach out and build relationships with anybody who would talk to me. Now, of course, I'm a crazy extrovert, and I talked to absolutely everybody, but what a remarkable thing to learn when you're 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, that you are powerful, that you can go and take your little agency on your bicycle and you can run to the store and you can solve that problem. Mm-hmm. And I think there was something, you know, I think I didn't get trapped in the limitations of other people's ideas of what was right and what was wrong. Mm. So I took that part of my life into my career, and I just felt like, well, if you see something wrong in the world, you should go and change it.
Mm-hmm.
And this sense of, I don't know, what is parenting, right? You know, I have 2 children of my own now. And one of the things that I talk about is the power of benign neglect, mm-hmm. which is maybe we should do a little less parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And let our children feel powerful by learning how to cross the street and go to the store and to, you know, return the food. My father used to get me to return the food to the grocery store because he was embarrassed to do it. But I was fearless. I'd do anything. So, you know, you take that kind of sense of possibility and the strong spiritual practice and this sort of, like my dad always said, if you can imagine it, it is true. If you can imagine it, it is true. And so anything that I could imagine, I was already working through the plan to get there. It was just who you had to talk to and how you needed to make those connections. And so, you know, I don't know. I think really the gift of my childhood was not being all that parented.
Yeah.
You know, it was a little less parenting.
Yeah.
A little more sense of anything is possible if you can imagine it. And then, you know, as I grew up, I was blessed with teachers who, you know, were providing me with the frameworks to understand the world in a little bit more of an organized fashion from my wild days. And I remember my first real existential epiphany was, of course, I was raised during the Cold War. You were as well, probably, Jeffrey. And there was this threat that we were all going to be blown up tomorrow.
Yeah.
It was real. And I don't think people who are children today really understand the fear that existed in our bodies as young people when we thought, you know, at 12 years old, I thought at any moment we could be gone. We could just be gone.
Yep.
So now we're pretty sure we're in trouble in terms of climate change. But at that moment, the fear of the bomb. And that really helped me to get my head around, you know, communism, capitalism, and Russia and America, and how we were looking at the world. And I was very interested from a very young age about what was the kind of construct of capitalism versus socialism, and why was it that they were at odds? Like, what was it? And in my early days, my first body of work was really looking at this world, like, how do you harness the power of capitalism to make the world better? Mm-hmm. You know, socialism stood for collective action. How do we do things together? How do we make the world better together? But we saw that capitalism was winning because it was tapping into the power of self-interest.
Yeah.
From a very, very early age, I became really engaged in this question, like, how do we align our self-interests to create a collective impact? And this is really the core of what I'm working on and have been working on my entire life.
So let's get into that, because I too find that a lot of folks, when they're working on stuff, think in a bifurcated fashion around those two things. Either I'm doing this altruistic thing, or I'm doing a self-interested thing, or only speaking to people's self-interest, right? When I'm doing marketing with people, for example, of course we need to look at their own pain and struggle, their own desires on one hand, but I also love to do what I call mission-based marketing, which is to remind people of their potential and of the collective mission that an audience can be about together. Mm-hmm. And the two can work so harmoniously together in the world of marketing. Now, I want to hear about what you've learned over the years about putting these two worlds together, and maybe some examples of places you've done it.
Mm-hmm. I remember being in a bookstore and reading all of these sort of management books and looking at the covers, because I didn't read much, but I read the covers. And my first project was Earth Shoppers. I started a little nonprofit when I was 19 or 20 years old, and it was called Earth Shoppers. And I was going to save the world through the power of positive consumption, right? That was going to be my thing. I was like an environmentalist. I really cared about the planet. And I figured if we could, you know, with all of my education and sort of the way economics work, if we could just get consumers to start shopping for a better planet, it should all work out, right? Wasn't that the capitalist dream that, you know, you exert market influence and then boom, it's just supposed to magically happen. So that naivete lasted about a year or two. And that was probably my first failure. You know, it went down not great, but I was experimenting and trying to understand how to tap into the energy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I really went, which is like, money is energy.
Yeah.
And we have not necessarily finished working out the right way to ensure that money is flowing within a system that will be more equitable and regenerative. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the punchline of me is I'm obsessed with shifting our economic systems to be more people and planet focused. But that I think we have the design answers already. They are circles, and so if I had to say what's my big learning, my big lesson is that everything we need to know about how to make the world a better place, we learned before we got to kindergarten, and it's in the shape of a circle. And we have to stop thinking like a pyramid, or a triangle in our economic or any systems. And we need to start thinking about how we build circles into our decision-making processes, into our financial systems, into the way that we design our water systems, our solar, our energy. You know, what does a circle do? A circle eliminates the concept of waste, human waste or material waste, because you have to include everything in a circle. And what if we were to take a look at what they're developing in the circular economy around materials and actually extend it to our social systems, so that we're actually building? I think the answer, I mean, I'm getting way, way ahead of myself. We can go back to some of the other things, but the answer is, I think, what I would call circularism. What I feel has to come after capitalism is circularism. How do we build every single system to actually be inclusive and regenerative and bring energy and positivity to every single transaction that we make? So that's what I'm trying to do everywhere I go, Jeffrey. So everywhere.
I want to hear about this, especially in the social world, because I've seen that in different places like food, right? Where we grow it, we take whatever we aren't using for this and we use it over here, or maybe we compost it and we bring it back into the soil and there's the circle, right? Some manufacturing that has similar concepts built into it. How do you see it in the world of how we are as people together in the social sphere?
Yes, great. So first, let's just take a look at decision-making, right? Where did our ancestors, how did our ancestors used to make decisions? The elders would go into circle and they would go into council with one another and they would seek consensus. Okay, maybe not always consensus. Sometimes hierarchies emerge, but if we go back far enough, decisions, some of the best decisions happen when we have our circles, our council of elders that help us to make those decisions. We know that that's where increasingly decision-making, if we look at management theory, we recognize that we need to have frontline people with experience to be a part of these decisions. We need all of the stakeholders to have a voice in these decisions, because if we don't hear all of those different voices, we're not able to make effective decisions. So decision-making and governance, I think, can be really informed and inspired by the circle. But I also see it in how we have excluded populations in the past. So, you know, in our countries, our issues around diversity and equity are essential that we begin to bring, that we rip down this hierarchical privileged infrastructure, this system which privileges only certain people, and we actually flatten that and we include. And as a wise person told me that the way that they think about how do we do diversity and inclusion, we need a bigger table, which is round, right? Uh-huh. How do we create these round tables, the bigger one?
What's your experience around this? My imagination, when people are hearing what you're talking about, like, oh, that's great. That sounds very nice.
How practical. How impractical.
Right. But what about the people who have power that don't want to give it up?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is where I think we have a really interesting question to deal with here in our world, right? Like, I see that time and time again. And I think the question that I go back to when I look at this tension between how do we redistribute wealth? How do we give up power? How do we move it into other places? I think for one thing, we are addicted to a definition of success, which is a lie. So I think if you take a look at people with all of this, so often you're meeting people who've made it. They've made it. They've cashed out. They've become successful in this thing, and they're still unsatiated in their souls. So what is it about our current dominant definition of success that we need to question? So how much do I really need to be happy? And what is happiness? How am I satiated as a human? The question for me has been one of these really interesting things, like what goes in a life? what really goes in a life, right? Is it money? Is it stuff? Okay, certainly we have some base needs, but if you're really looking at your soul and you say, what do I need to be fulfilled as a human? I'm going to butcher it. Who was the Holocaust survivor who wrote that extraordinary little book? He was
Viktor Frankl.
Thank you, Viktor Frankl. And it was called
Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes, that's the one. I read that. I went into deep meditation and I came up with three things. What do we have and what do we need in a life? For me, and maybe for you, I seek joy, belonging, and purpose. Mm-hmm. How can we craft our lives so that we are fulfilled and we can achieve and feel joy, belonging, and purpose? How much wealth do we really need? How many things do we really need to be satiated? So that's the first thing. I think we are at a pandemic level of people with all the money and all the privilege in the world and still feeling unhappy and miserable. And I beg us to take a look at the spiritual crisis that's going on there. But then I'm going to answer the question a different way, which is maybe not quite so spiritual, which is to say, you know, I believe that social change is not about demands, but about seduction.
Okay, let's get into that.
That's where I'm at, right? Is, look, I think everybody wants to do good in the world. I really don't think that there's a mean-spirited person out there. There might be defensive people, people who feel attacked, people who feel that there's no truth. I see all of the symptoms, but I think if we can make the pathway to the redistribution, to a more balanced economic system, we can make it fun. We can make it not painful. We can make it a way that we're building relationship, that we're building a relationship with each other, with nature, that we're reprioritizing not ourselves as the dominant species, but really the planet as the thing which gives us life. You know, what an amazing adventure.
How do you make that seductive?
I think it's good ideas. I actually think it's innovation, right? I think the core of what I'm trying to do at the Center for Social Innovation is to really look at how we prove that new business models and new solutions can be scaled to create that seduction. I don't think anybody wants the old system, actually. They just want to live well. So yeah. I don't think it's about people holding on to power. I don't. I think it's about us needing to find new ways of redistributing wealth that are inclusive and regenerative and that bring people joy.
I love this word seduction, and I'm going to ask you for an example of this in a minute. I will just say, when I started my work, part of my work, I examined the patterns of people's core wounds to understand the underlying pattern of their audience so that I can know what problems that audience is experiencing because of that patterning that we can market to, right? That's the basic rudimentary basis of some of my work. And I remember after doing this for a number of years, and I stumbled on it, you know, I worked with this marketer and I used to do work with people around their wounds around power. And she'd say, oh, I worked with so-and-so, here's their market, here's the market's craving. And I'd say, well, I could have told you that given who they are and what they have been through, of course, that's the market. And over the years, one of the problems I've solved for people is, who really am I meant to serve? Right? Who really am I meant to serve with this thing, with this idea, with this innovation, et cetera? And helping people get really like Johnny on the spot, crystal clear about it. Now, the mechanism for it is, let's just take a peek at your core wounds, right? The last thing the ego ever wants to look at. La, 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 right? Don't want to see it. And I just remember at one point, and this is work that felt like it found me. I don't feel like my brilliant mind made it up. It kind of landed and I accepted it. Mm-hmm. And at one point I remember thinking, wow, that is sneaky. I'm taking the thing they want most. I want to know who this is for. I want to get it out to the world. I want to make money doing it. I want all these things. And, you know, this system saying, oh, great, we can get you that. No problem whatsoever. Right. In fact, we can get you so clear on who this is for, unlike anything you've ever experienced. No problem. By the way, we're just going to like pass through, you know, go on this little journey into your core wounds and the process.
Right.
And it's been amazing over all these years. How many people say, oh, okay. Right. Like, I need it bad enough. It's seductive enough that I'm willing to go there. And that's what has taught me about seduction is like dangling. Hey, look, this thing you want, I can get you there. In fact, I can get you there better than the old systems do. We're just going to have to do some processes that maybe you weren't going to love for a little bit in route to get you there.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm curious in the work you've done, what are some of the things that you've worked on that like, wow, that was really seductive.
Well, so it's a great question. And I love seduction because it's clever, right? It means that you, you know, the Buck Minister Fuller's got his quote about, you know, you work to create a system, but if it's not beautiful, it's not done, right? It's not good. So wonderful quote. But so I would say, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is the community bond. And so I'll take you on a little journey there. So, you know, the Center for Social Innovation is a not-for-profit social mission organization who has served, the intro was not exactly right. It was 700. It missed a zero. That's okay. That's my fault.
Right.
We serve about 700 to 900 organizations at any one day when we're fully in a post-COVID world, I hope. So, you know, one of the questions is, we're a little nonprofit organization. I'm trying to change the world. We've built this amazing community of people, and we've innovated this wonderful new thing. At the time, we were one of the first co-working spaces in the world. Uh-huh. And the co-working concept itself was an act of seduction, right? We had figured out in the nonprofit sector that people needed to share. It was a business problem. The photocopier lease was $500 a month. Well, if your entire annual budget is less than $1 million and you have fewer than five staff, how are you going to approve or pay for a $500 a month lease?
Yeah.
So my idea back then was, how do we share? Right. And so the first act of seduction was figuring out what people really want. So they came to us needing an office space, and they didn't want to have as much, they didn't want to spend as much money on photocopiers, fax machines, kitchens, meeting rooms. Remember fax machines?
Oh, yeah.
And that was the first seduction. And mm-hmm. What was really interesting is the real magic, the real seduction was belonging, right? We brought people into a room to share a photocopier, and what we ended up building was belonging. So the first act of seduction was to create a product, a service that had all of the elements of belonging, of efficiency, and it was going to help these organizations. Our mission was to help these not-for-profit social purpose organizations work across difference and through across silos. So how do you get arts groups talking to environment groups, talking to anti-racist groups, talking to, you know, social justice? So we experimented with 14 organizations, and we proved that. In fact, they came for the office space and they stayed for the community.
Okay. I want to just pause there real quick, because what you just pointed out, similar to what I was sharing, is that seduction starts with a problem they're already aware of.
That's right.
Right. It's a known problem. It's the rock in their shoe.
Yeah.
Right. And go like, okay. And then you did the scrappy thing.
Yeah.
Right. The gift of your childhood thing of going, well, what's another way?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. How can we get them to share a copy machine?
That's right.
And then in the back door, there's this other thing that occurs, which is belonging and community.
That's right. That's right. And we did this very intentionally, because at the core of how I believe change happens is by building relationship and building trust.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they say change happens at the speed of trust. Well, how do we reduce the friction and speed up that trust? So co-working was the first seduction, right? And it was, we called it virtual tenancy. It was 2004. It was way before Silicon Valley coined it as co-working. It was not nearly as elegant, but it worked and it grew quickly.
Yeah.
And you knew that it had the seductive abilities because people love 2 feet. They kept coming. And so when we, 6 years later, had proven that we had a basic business model, again, as this little nonprofit, scrappy social entrepreneur, I had the crazy audacious idea that we should buy a building. Now, our revenues were $400,000 a year. I had not a single asset. The banks, I called them up. They said, can you help me buy a building? They said, well, what kind of assets do you have? I said, well, I have some desks. And they're like, yeah, no. No.
Right.
So the question was, how do you seduce people into wanting to be a part of the solution?
Yeah.
It was a really interesting moment. How does this little nonprofit organization create something that we can then scale as this, as an idea? And we took the idea to the city of Toronto. We asked for a loan guarantee. They ended up giving it to us. Thank God, that changed our history and future as an organization. We then took it to a credit union, Alterna Credit, and they gave us a mortgage. And they said, okay, Tanya, this is a 4.8. You basically need to raise $2 million of your own money. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I got nothing. Well, again, how does, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Just tell that you tell it. I had to come up with a way. I said, well, what do I have? I said, I have friends. Mm-hmm. I have relationships. I have community. And that was the moment when I realized that I could turn my social capital into financial capital. And I could create an offering, the bond, which would allow my community to invest. And we successfully raised $2 million in under 6 months and created the first ever community bond that allowed us to buy our first building. We then have done it subsequently, and we've now raised about $7.5 million from 350 community investors for investments that are as little as $1,000, all the way up to $500,000 to be able to buy the two buildings that we own in Toronto that are now worth about $45 million. Nice. So why do they buy? Why do they invest? Okay. They could walk into it. They loved it. We're giving them a 4% return. That's not bad in this economy. Thank you very much. They get to support something they actually believe in, and it's concrete and it's real, and they can be a part of the change. It was a concrete way that we saw people say, I want to be a part of the solution.
Yeah.
Give me a way to engage with you. I want to do good. I choose to be on this way of building community. And we gave them a win-win opportunity that was concrete and real. Our last raise, we raised $2 million in under 45 days. Investors love it. Individuals. And who are the investors? They're not accredited investors. They're community. They're people that care. They're members. My executive assistant, she invested right away. Like, that's the community building. Because what we're not doing in the world, Jeffrey, is we're not creating positive opportunities enough for people to act and be their best selves. So this is the innovation challenge that we have. How do we, as social innovators, how do we create the new models that will enable people to be the best people that they can be, to be a part of the solution? I think that's the magic. And I think it's going to take a lot of creativity. And it's not about tech innovation, might be, but it's about being way more creative about how we let people be a part of the solution.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm thinking about when I've been at like gala fundraisers, you know, and I can't quite pinpoint it, but there's energetically something different that I'm hearing in what you're talking about. I think it's related to the seduction. I think it is related to a clear vision, so they know what they are a part of. This piece around allowing them to be their best selves You know, oftentimes, maybe this is what it is. You tell me what you think about this. But I think a lot in not-for-profit fundraising, it's guilt-based.
Yes, I don't like it.
And like you can buy your way out of your first, we're going to heap the guilt on you. And then guess what? You can buy your way out of it.
It's also a patronizing power dynamic. And I think it's bullshit.
Yeah.
And I don't buy it and I don't like it and I don't want to be a part of it. You know, I met with the CEO of a major Canadian foundation recently, and she said to me, and I was so happy. She says, don't call yourself a grantee anymore. You are a partner. You deliver real value. Without you, we are nothing. Now that is a shift in power. But right now, I mean, one of the reasons that I spent 5 years chairing the Ontario Nonprofit Network and helped to organize that sector was because I'm so sick of that flies in the eyes, patronizing, philanthropic approach, which doesn't actually recognize the extraordinary value that the social mission sector provides to the world. Mm-hmm. We are equal. We are different, but we are equal. In fact, I might argue we're better. Thank you very much. So how do we actually change that power dynamic? Fundamentally shifting this thing from, you know, waiting to, and this is maybe many of your listeners may recognize this, like we have to stop thinking that we'll do good when we're rich. Right? That the philanthropy comes after. Well, wait a second. We need a fundamental rethink about all of the systems that we're operating in. And one of the ones that I'm closely related to is this nonprofit charitable sector. And look, the work that the charitable sector does to meet the needs of humans and ecosystems around the world is extraordinary. They are the hardest working, most professionalized, extraordinary group of people I've ever had the pleasure of working with in my life. And they are meeting multiple needs. And that fact that they're always put into this, like we need to beg for philanthropy, is disrespectful to the work that they're doing. We must ask ourselves, why are the people that they serve in the situation that they're in? And what can we do to change the system, which is holding us stuck in this misalignment? This is coming back to capitalism, it's coming back to any system. The field of social innovation is about the study of systems. Why is it that we're doing the things we're doing, and might we be able to shift this system so it's more regenerative, more circular, more equitable, more inclusive? And the first system to look at is philanthropy. Why do these people go hungry? Why do we need meal programs? Why? What's going on here? How do we work together, build the social capital to look at fundamentally shifting the system so that people don't have to be begging for handouts? What happened to us that we can't have more dignity and respect in the way we treat people? Oh, I just went on that rant, Jeffrey. You got me on a soft spot, because it's not okay. It's not okay to be treating our entire social mission, nonprofit, charitable sector like second-class citizens. It's not okay.
So two things there. One, one of the things we haven't gotten here in this conversation, but I love that you have embraced rage.
You just got a little piece of it.
just a little taste. Just a little taste. Like a little moose boosh.
I'm all right? Love until I'm rage, honey.
All right. And I think that, like, I know you've talked about rage versus complacency or victim culture. And so here's a little taste of that rage around this sector. There's two places I want to go, but I want to take a little sideways, or a little step to the right here for a minute, or maybe it's the left or backwards or forward. I don't know. Just a little side note. What have you learned about embracing rage in service to your work in the world?
So you talk about the core wounds. So Jeffrey, let's go there. You know, little girl Tanya didn't have a mommy around, and I felt abandoned, right? That was the abandonment issues of that. And I think my core rage is to be seen, to be heard, you know? My rage has given me the energy to keep fighting. And it's interesting. I guide people, you know, what do you want? What's your purpose? What should you be doing? Well, you really do need to tap into the rage of something that drives you so deeply to keep you going in this work, right? It's, for me, it's this, it's about this power dynamic. You know, it's about efficiency. It's about why do people who should be working together not work together? Like, what's going on here? It's like a completely ridiculous. Why can't we get our shit together? Like, that's what I want to know. Why? And what can I do? So, you know, that rage is the thing which gives me the energy. And then the question is, how do I use that energy and then make sure that I'm not self-harming in the process?
Just a little piece, like, was, and it probably wasn't a logical thought process, but was, if you look back, did little Tanya have a, like, why can't my parents get their shit together? Like, why couldn't they get their shit together and like stay together and raise us?
You know, I have to say they split up before I was old enough to process that kind of a thought.
Yeah.
You know, I just think I thought anything was possible. Yeah. Like I really do. Like, I just feel like, I mean, look, I was also my rage manifested in other ways, being, you know, having too much hubris and thinking I was, you know, able to do, maybe a little overconfidence. I mean, no, I don't know. That's a good therapy question for me.
Yeah. So I sometimes play with motivation and leadership.
Yeah.
And I play with away from or towards motivators.
Right.
And oftentimes I find that our wounded motivation, unattended to, untransformed, is like a hot potato, right? I don't want to touch that. I don't want to be with that in myself or in others. And a lot of times in social innovation, I see that people are trying to change something out in the world that, you know, they want to change in themselves. As we do our own healing, there can be a replacement fuel.
Yeah, that's right.
That is more regenerative.
That's right.
That hot potato, I can't touch it. I don't want to be with it. That push away, I often think of it as like nuclear power, right? Like, it's powerful. Woo, it'll drive you to do a lot of stuff in the world, but it has its consequences. And eventually those consequences are going to show up in your life or in your body or in your relationship or wherever. But then there is this place of desire. What do I want just because I want it, right? Like, and you might even go into like, what's my dream for my life? Or what's my dream for this world? Or what's my dream for this sector or for this company? Or, right, what that, and there is this kind of, to me, taps into that joy piece you were talking about, right? Like, and it's like, it has an aliveness to it, kind of like rage does, but it's a slightly different quality. Like, how has that transformed for you over the years of doing work?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful question. And thank you, because it's, you know, I have a motto. It's actually one of the values. If you go to the CSI website, you'll see our values. And one of them is make social change and have fun doing it. And that's my personal commitment, because, you know, I'm not sure that I can actually have an impact on the world. And in fact, I probably won't have that much. And I want to be cautious that I don't burn myself out in the process. And mm-hmm. So I like to channel that rage into creativity, into a great glass of wine. Like, they really, they describe the champagne socialist. I'm for sure a champagne socialist, right? I'm looking for the solutions, but not at the expense of the quality of my own life or the lives of others.
Yeah.
So, you know, this question, process or product, well, both matter, but the process you have to live through, right? And, you know,
Hold on. Process or product, but the process you have to live through.
Right.
That, there, oof. I know so many people out trying to do good in the world that are just killing themselves doing it.
That's right. And I can't do it anymore. And I don't want to. And you know what? I see so many people self-harming. This is why I say it's self-harming. their quest to save the world is so great that they forget to enjoy and be alive. Well, Alan Watts says, the purpose of life is to be alive. So yeah. Let us actually embrace this beautiful life. And so this is my mantra, make social change and have fun doing it. Because that balance is what I can live with.
Yeah.
I can hold those. I'm going to do my best. I'm going to be as creative, as innovative, as solutions oriented, as powerfully as I can to bring about the change I want to see in the world that I see as collective benefit for so many. But I'm not going to do it at the expense of my own quality of life or the lives of my people, because it self-harming only hurts others around us too. And I think one of the things you said, which really resonates with me, is this. I've been working at the Center for Social Innovation for 17 years now. And about 3 years ago, I took a sabbatical. And I did this little exercise where I was recognizing that I've come to this age and this place in my life where the rage is no longer what drives me. The fire had burnt out of that rage.
Mm-hmm.
I can see it in others. I love it. I honor it. I celebrate it. Oh, I love good rage. I love it. But there was something else that was my spark. And, you know, it's this interesting question when you get to a place in your own personal development where you recognize that you're not here for you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That you're here for your people, for your community, and for the world. And that really my mission is to serve, right? And that the fire may be maybe not quite so bright and fiery, but it's still there, it's ever present, and it's a precious, precious light that allows me to move from rage-based movement into service-based leadership. And it's a lot easier to take, and the quality of the life is that much richer.
Yeah. If you took a couple more questions here. One, when you look at your own work and where we're at in this world and the work you like, what's your vision for your own future? And the work you are here to do?
I think I'm trying to figure that out. Like, I think I'm personally trying to figure that out, right? Like, you know, I know in my heart that I'm an innovator and an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And, you know, like many people who are listening, I'm not sure I'm the best CEO. There's probably better people out there to manage. And so I'm personally, I think my own path will be one of working with others to create new solutions. I like this. I like small teams. I like being in relationship, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to work on national things. I want to work on relationships with humans. That's where that's where I get my joy. I get my joy from, you know, getting references on what kind of air conditioning system I should be buying. That makes me happy, you know, like yeah. It's, and, you know, I think that there's an enormous amount that we can do in building trust and working across difference. I think our world is desperate for it right now. And so I see my work in the future being building belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And building new cultures that allow us to thrive. And I don't know how I'm going to do that. You know, yeah. I love where I am right now. So maybe we'll do it right where I am. But you know, I want new economic systems. I want new ways of modeling the world. But in the design of each of these, we need to build joy, belonging, and meaning, right? We need to build. These are the core for me, joy, belonging, and meaning. And those three ingredients have the foundation to change cultures And it's the changing of these cultures, the building of relationship across difference, across sectors, across, you know, multi-sectoral partnerships. It's about building that trust, which lies at the foundation of everything. And until we can start speaking across those differences, you know, it's not, the arguments are not in left or right. It's so annoying that, you know, you can always get down to a level of granularity where we all love our children, right? Mm-hmm. We all care for people at a deep level. We just have different ideas around, and the media has allowed us to become polarized. And I reject that. I want to bring together people who are willing to talk across those differences, and the solutions are in the little teeny weeny ways that we might be able to redesign some of the simplest of things that we might all agree on. And we've done it before. So, you know, the one project that I'm most proud of was the work that our team did on toxics and kids' health. And the reason I'm most proud of it is because we did a multi-stakeholder process that brought together chemical producers, oil and gas, consumer products, health advocates, activists who are anti-lead and anti, you know, vaccine, and all sorts of these things. And we actually were able to ban one substance in one product in one country that triggered a global market transformation around plastics. And we did that because we spent time to figure out what we agreed on. And that's the core. It's not what do we disagree on. That's a divisive and stupid question. The question that we must ask each other is, what do we agree on? Let's start from the asset base and build our systems around the things that we can agree on. I think that's where we need to start this work. And I think we're going to need everyone. Everyone has a role to play, no matter where you come from, what's your background, where you are, what stage of life. Ultimately, everyone can be a part of the solution. And the most creative of us, I hope, will make sure that any of our solutions allow everyone to be a part of that. Because people want to do good. They love our planet. We love each other at our core. And we just need to be more creative about how we redesign these systems and not let the destructive ones divide us.
Yep. I think we're going to wrap it there. I often start, end with a question of like, what do you want most for people in the world? But I think you just shared it.
I want most for Jeffrey. I want you to be my best friend and stay on call on my app for all of the best answers for everything. And you know, honestly, there's something beautiful about this conversation because you have asked such beautiful questions, Jeffrey. I just want to honor and recognize the power of the question. The questions open up imaginations. And you did beautiful question asking. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. From the moment I met you, I was like, ah, one of my new besties. So it's just a joy to have you here. Hopefully we can have you back. And where can people find out more about you and the work you do? Where can we send them?
Socialinnovation.org. It's the simple, you can find out everything you want to know. And I'd love to hear from folks. It's anybody who's doing this work, you're looking for ways to connect. And we need to build a movement, my friends. We do. So yeah, beautiful. Come join us, sign up, and we'll tell you all about what we're up to.
Awesome. Socialinnovation.org. Tani Sermon, thank you so, so much for your time, for your heart, and for your generous work in this world.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Hey there. Thanks so much for listening in. If this conversation was powerful, if it stirred your soul or inspired your journey, then be sure to share it with a friend. Just copy and paste the link wherever you're listening to this podcast and text that link right now to a friend that you think would be inspired by this episode. And if this is your first time here, be sure to click that subscribe button over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd leave a rating and review so I can get to know you and your thoughts better. To learn more about the work I do with emerging and established paradigm changers, go to thecourageousmessenger.com. That's all for today. Thanks so much for being here, and I hope to see you in the next episode.